Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. And welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for April the 8th, 2018. Yes, it's April, but we're still waiting for spring to have sprung. Thanks for joining us as we take our weekly look at the world of politics and policy. We'll take you from City Hall to Springfield and all the way out to Washington, D.C. So it's time to grab that Sunday paper, get that hot cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week off to a good start. Well, this cold weather just continues, and I know that there's snow in the overnight forecast.
It's one of those snow accumulations where it will be on the grassy areas. Wouldn't cause much of a problem on the roadways, but you never know. You know, things could be slippery out there. But interesting statistic here, Rick. This is the third straight sub-40 degree day in April, and the record low was 20 degrees set in 1972, and we were just a couple degrees away from it right now.
Wow. Wow. I mean, we're still talking about wind chills here.
Yes.
In April.
Yes.
We're talking about snow in April. This weather, those last couple of snow days didn't do anybody's mood any good at Tribune Tower. And
not only at Tribune Tower.
Well, yeah, but I mean, but watching the TV of the White Sox home opener with the snow falling down at Comiskey Park, that looked like a treat to be at.
It's like a snow globe.
Well, and then, yeah, and then they let that game really slip away, too.
Mm-hmm.
And it looked to me, Andy,
yes,
that in the ninth inning, there was one out in the ninth, they're up by three runs, and it looked like the umpire was calling low strikes because, like, he wanted to get the heck out of there, and then they still choked it up.
Yeah, it was a tough one. Certainly not the way you want to have opening day go, especially when you have a three-run lead going into the ninth inning.
No, and, you know, now granted, you know, we know that this is a young team and they're going about things the right way, but you just hate to see giving one away. Mm-hmm. I mean, those are the ones that can make the difference between a 70-win and a 90-win season, you know?
It's true. It's true. And, you know, the thing about it is, and it's not to make excuses because everybody around there is saying the same thing. I mean, this is a learning kind of a year with, but you can't really say the same thing about Joaquin Soria. I mean, this guy's a veteran closer, so it doesn't really apply there. But you know, you have chances to add on, and you don't. And those are kind of lessons that young teams need to learn. That you know, when you have an opportunity to add on, you have to add on.
Right, and you know, it's the old cliche about you know, wins in April count every bit as much as they do in September.
That's one less win you have to have in September.
Correct. When it comes down to crunch time. But very frustrating. The Cubs did the opposite yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And winning against Milwaukee. And now we've got opening day at Wrigley on Monday. And a competing game with the White Sox, yeah, having moved up their time frame,
mm-hmm,
from a night game to a day game tomorrow. So, we'll see if there's snow on the grass at both places.
Yeah, there could be.
Oh, man.
It's just, you know, it just screams baseball season, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. Well, I mean, it's good to have baseball with the end of hockey. And, you know, I don't want to say it was an unmemorable season because, mm-hmm, there were some very distinct memories. And I will tell you, one of the memories that I'll take away is last night,
yeah,
in Winnipeg, with both teams wearing their nameplates as Broncos, mm-hmm, in honor of the Humboldt Junior A team after that horrific crash killed 15 people. The other 14 on the bus, hospitalized. It really, you know, it's why, part of why I appreciate hockey, because, mm-hmm, it is such a small kind of sport. It's this great camaraderie.
Yeah, it's family.
And yeah, it is family. And kind of bringing it full circle for me was the fact that Humboldt in Saskatchewan, that's where the person who wore the number one for the Blackhawks came from.
Glenn Hall?
Glenn Hall.
Yep.
Native of Humboldt. And, you know, we're all thinking about everybody up there. Their GoFundMe page has raised $3 million.
Yeah. Each NHL team contributing $25,000 as well.
Right.
That certainly helps. And I don't know if you caught it on the radio broadcast last night, but toward the end of the third period, there was a chant going up in Winnipeg, and it was, "Let's go Humboldt."
Huh. Wow.
And it was pretty cool. I mean, it was... It seemed very spontaneous and unorchestrated, and it caught on. It happened a couple of times, and the other thing that you got to tip your as they say your hockey helmet to the folks up in Winnipeg. They made an announcement about Patrick Sharp's final game. He's born in Winnipeg, and they gave him a standing ovation.
Yeah, that's class. That's class. That's hockey. And also in hockey-related news, I'm proudly wearing the cap of the University of Minnesota Duluth Bulldogs, your NCAA Frozen Four national champions.
How about that?
After defeating Notre Dame last night.
I was following your tweets.
You couldn't tell I was a little excited.
No,
right?
Not at all. And it all came back to me, and I'm thinking to myself, wait. And I went out, I clicked on the link, and I'm like, oh, that's the hat. Duh. That's the hat that Rick wears all the time.
That's the Bulldogs hat. Yeah. Yes. And then in honor of my dad's side of the family from up near Duluth. So I proudly am wearing the Bulldogs cap today. And probably won't take it off for a week.
Good idea.
No, that's a fantastic win. Although I thought it was kind of weird that they were playing in St. Paul. You know,
yeah.
It's not exactly neutral ice territory there. Frozen.
Did you hear anything from Aunt Jo during this at all?
She just kind of responded on the Twitter. I know she was excited with the win too. But I'll talk to her later today because I was kind of getting towards bedtime last night with that game and the Hawks in Winnipeg. But and as you said, Andy, Patrick Sharp, mm-hmm. I mean, what can you say? I mean, thanks for everything.
Absolutely. And I'll echo what many of his teammates said after the game, that especially the ones that he's played with for a long time, they don't win three championships without the contributions of Patrick Sharp. Even though in 15, I think there was a little question about skills diminishing, and he wasn't as present, I guess, if you could say, in the 15.
He wasn't as agile, think, you know.
He had that one goal where Victor Hedman and Ben Bishop collided.
Right.
And he had the empty netter in the first period up in down there, I guess, in Tampa Bay. But, you know, with the fact that he is being credited with really helping the development of Patrick Kane and Jonathan Toews, and some of that younger crew that was there when he first started, and to think that he was at the Metro stations handing out tickets in a full jersey with nobody knowing who the heck he was in 2005 to going now where he can't walk on the streets alone.
Yeah, it's great. It's a great story, great career. Absolutely fantastic career. And we got the news about Stan Bowman and Coach Q coming back.
I like
which
that.
Is good.
I like that move. And I think the key word in that whole sentence from John McDonough, the president and CEO of the Blackhawks, is continuity.
Right.
If you think you can find somebody better, okay, go ahead and get them. But I don't think you're going to find too many coaches that are better than Joel Quenneville, and I don't think you're going to find too many GMs that have a track record. And yeah, every GM makes a mistake every once in a while. You sign a guy to a bad contract, you make a bad trade. But overall, I think the resume kind of speaks for themselves.
And now we'll look ahead to the draft and see what kind of off-season player changes come, and we'll look ahead to next year.
And before you know it, the convention will be here.
Yes, it will.
It'll be time to drop the puck again.
And, you know, let's face it, not that I'm anything against winning a Stanley Cup, but when you win the Cup, that makes for a very prolonged season.
Oh, yeah.
And a very short turnaround into the next season.
Lots of stress, too.
So, thank you, Blackhawks, for a good season and a lot of good memories. And remember, Scott Foster will be in the press box if we ever need
him. Yes, he'll be there.
Are either one of you ready to make any predictions as to who's going to be in the finals here? with the playoffs?
So hard to tell. It's so hard to tell, you know, without playing.
Well, it goes on for so long.
It goes on for a couple months. Yeah, Nashville obviously would be the odds-on favorite winning the President's Cup, but that's not always a guarantee. And there's two teams in the East this year that are pretty darn good, and they're both in the same division, and that would be the Tampa Bay Lightning and the Boston Bruins.
Okay.
Keep your eye on Winnipeg.
Winnipeg also. I like the way they play. They remind me a little bit of that first Blackhawks team that won the championship in 10.
Mm-hmm. And they're taking on the Minnesota Wild. Mm-hmm. So I will be hearing from Aunt Jo on that. and there now, of course, we can't put St. Louis into this.
They're out. They are out.
They are out.
The Avalanche beat them last night 5-2 to take the final playoff spot in the Western Conference. And I know that there's so many Blackhawks fans that are shedding huge amounts of tears. There's been a huge run on Kleenex boxes at Walgreens. I know that. But, yeah, the Blues are out.
Yeah. So they're stuck with the Cardinals.
Mm-hmm.
And the Cardinals seem to be stuck.
Yeah, and that's another really awful thing, isn't it?
You just take the words right out of my mouth, Andy. I don't even have to show my true feelings
at
all.
It's all good. I got you.
I was sitting next to a Cardinals fan who showed her true feelings once at Wrigley Field many years ago.
They don't hesitate to show their true
feelings. No, they don't.
Not at all. Well, Dave's here to keep us up on all the news. Andy has the latest sports. Producer Ben is here for Producer Cassara. Field your calls. We're at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin, on Twitter at @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob is practicing his master's style putting here in the Showcase studio. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNradio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. Up ahead on the show, after we catch up on the news and sports at 7:30, we'll speak with Democratic State Senator Michael Hastings of Tinley Park. We'll talk to him about issues surrounding problems of veterans' health at the Downstate Quincy Veterans Home and also issues going on in Springfield. After the news at the top of the hour, we'll speak to a good friend of the program, WTTW Channel 11 correspondent Amanda Vinicky. And we'll talk to Amanda about the political campaigns that lie ahead and some of the issues that lawmakers will face when they return to Springfield this week. We'll have more news and sports at 8:30, and then we'll speak to Illinois House Republican leader Jim Durkin of Western Springs. We'll talk about Republicans going forward in this campaign season, as well as what to expect in Springfield this week. That's all coming up, but now it's time for our weekly spin through national politics. We've had another week of tweets and statements from President Trump, continuing to sow controversy and chaos. President already tweeting several times this morning about China and China trade and trade barriers, trade war, talking about the fact that he's quoting Fox and Friends, so we know what he's watching this morning. But with this chaos, you also have issues such as the president's desire to get U.S. forces out of Syria as quickly as possible.
I want to get out. I want to bring our troops back home. I want to start rebuilding our nation. We will have, as of 3 months ago, $7 trillion in the Middle East over the last 17 years. We get nothing out of it. Nothing. And as you remember, in civilian life, for years, I said, keep the oil. I was always saying, keep the oil. We didn't keep the oil. Who got the oil was ISIS got the oil, a lot of it. That's what funded their campaigns. They took a lot of the oil, and it was largely responsible for funding. We should have kept the oil then. We didn't keep the oil. So I want to get back. I want to rebuild our nation. Think of it, $7 trillion over a 17-year period. We have nothing, nothing except death and destruction. It's a horrible thing.
That's the president's desire, but then there's what's really possible. The commander of U.S. Central Forces, known as CENTCOM, is General Joseph Votel. Here's what the general says about Syria.
as the threat of ISIS has diminished, and it's not gone there yet, and I'll come back to that in a minute, but you've also begun to see the other underlying challenges that are apparent in Syria really kind of come to the forefront, and I think this is what we're seeing play out here right now. We've been largely successful and militarily in the areas in which we have been operating against ISIS. Well over 90% of the caliphate that they controlled, particularly in the north and eastern portions of the country, has been liberated. There still are some, some areas where they are present, and that we will have to continue to operate on. But the situation continues to become more and more complex.
More and more complex. And remember, these statements came even before these reports of chemical weapons attacks being used in Syria, killing dozens of people, injuring hundreds more. And that will add only to the complexity. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Up ahead on The Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking with Democratic State Senator Michael Hastings from Tinley Park. A lot of things to talk about with him as lawmakers return to Springfield on Monday for ending an extended kind of spring break that also included the post-primary break as well. We'll be talking to him about issues ahead in Springfield as well as deepening concerns about the care of veterans at the Quincy Veterans Home. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. We talked a little bit about the chaos going on in the Trump administration. Nothing new, but a lot of problems surrounding EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt. A lobbyist couple had to change the locks on Pruitt to get him out of their residence. A person familiar with the situation said, Scott Pruitt is the Cato Kalin of Capitol Hill. He's the long-term house guest who takes advantage of his hosts and refuses to take a hint about when it's time to leave. Then, AP sources reporting that the EPA chief spent millions of dollars on security and travel. Of course, the EPA says that's because the administrator has been receiving death threats, though a nationwide search of state and federal court records by AP found no case where anyone has been arrested or charged with threatening Pruitt. Then you have the issue of big pay raises for two friends, pay raises that the White House had originally disapproved of. Appearing on Fox News, Ed Henry talked to Pruitt about those pay raises.
Now, if you're committed to the Trump agenda, why did you go around the president and the White House to give pay raises to two staffers?
I did not. My staff did, and I found out about that yesterday, and I changed it.
So
PPPO process should have been respected, and I issued a statement yesterday walking back those pay raises that should not have been done.
So somebody being fired for that?
That it should not have been done.
And who did it?
It may be there would be some accountability.
A career person or a political person?
I don't know.
You don't know? You run the agency. You don't know who did this?
I found out about this yesterday, and I corrected the action.
So,
and we are in the process of finding out how it took place and correcting
it going
forward.
Both of these staffers who got these large pay raises are friends of yours, I believe, from Oklahoma, right?
They are staffers here in the agency.
Then they're friends of yours.
Well, they serve a very important person.
And you didn't know that they got these large pay raises?
I did not know that they got the pay raises until yesterday.
Okay, one of them got a pay raise of, let's see, $28,000. The other was $56,000. Do you know what the median income in this country is?
No, what?
$57,000 a year.
Okay.
So one of your friends from Oklahoma got a pay raise that's the medium income.
They did not get a pay raise. They did not get a pay raise.
They did?
No, they did not. They did not. I stopped that yesterday.
So you stopped it.
Yeah.
Are you embarrassed that
it should
you
not
run
have
this agency?
It should not have happened. And the officials that were involved in that process should not have done what they did.
That's Scott Pruitt on Fox News. Amid all the controversy, President Trump maintains he has confidence in the embattled EPA administrator, tweeting out his support recently and also speaking with reporters aboard Air Force One.
I think that Scott has done a fantastic job. I think he's a fantastic person. I just left coal and energy country. They love Scott Pruitt. They feel very strongly about Scott Pruitt, and they love Scott Pruitt.
They love Scott Pruitt. Well, joining me now on the phone is Democratic State Senator Michael Hastings from Tinley Park. He is the new chairman of the new Senate Energy Committee. And but I want to talk to you about Veterans Affairs first, Senator. Thanks for joining me this morning.
Rick, how are you? Belated Happy Easter, Happy Greek Easter.
and happy holidays to you, as always. Good to have you on the show. We saw last week a report that a makeover of the Illinois Veterans Home at Quincy could cost as much as $278 million, and that may be the best option to deal with the issues of the Quincy Veterans Home, the fact of the repeated outbreaks of Legionnaires' disease, a disease that claimed 13 lives there, continued problems with obtaining information about what exactly is going on down there with email redactions and things involving the Governor Rauner administration. How do you see moving forward on this issue?
Well, I see more confusion on the part of the executive branch, but just to paint the picture for the listeners, Rick, for people who don't know, I mean, over the last 3 years, there's been 13 veterans and that have passed away, died from Legionnaires' disease. Four more cases were revealed during, actually while we were holding a committee meeting and a committee hearing on this. And then all of a sudden, in the last month, we have an outbreak of norovirus. I mean, if it's not clear to the administration that something is going on at that home and they need to fix it, something's wrong. But, you know, there are estimations in terms of how much the cost to repair, you know, the veterans home. It's ranged now from $25 million to $285 million. It just seems to me to be a joke, especially the way they're handling this, and especially the way they're providing information to the legislative body. It's just very secretive.
What do you think should be done? Should those veterans be taken out of there and moved into a new facility? I know that there is some kind of facility that's available that the state could purchase that's in Quincy.
Yeah, you know, this is someone's home, and that's probably the hardest part about it, is when you're moving people who are there long term, moving them from their home, it's a very difficult process,
and they're very frail.
Yeah, people are dying, people are getting sick, and so you got to be very delicate about it. But you know, $265 million to repair it when we have a $70 million Chicago veterans home that's stalled, a brand new one for that matter. You know, sometimes you got to cut what you got to cut and move to, you know, move these people out so there's no more issues. And quite honestly, I don't know why the governor's not doing that. But then again, the governor seems to be just inundated with a lot of other things. And I said this before, I think 2-3 years ago, Rick, when I was on the show, he's just unfit to lead state government.
Do you know about how many veterans live at the Quincy Veterans Home?
Yeah, there's about 350 people live there. The buildings are about 109 years old. So it's obviously an older facility, and it's a great community. I mean, Adams County, just going down there and seeing it, it's just a beautiful place. So I can tell you the staff at this facility are first rate. But, even the staff at the facility, we had them in our testimony, our video testimony at our hearing, and, you know, we've had staff that were in, that contracted Legionnaires' disease, and honestly, the staff, the first time the outbreak happened, they really didn't know anything until they heard about it on Facebook or on the news. I find that very troubling. Right?
I mean, that seems to be, you know, I think we have two things at play. Is one is what do we do to help those veterans in Quincy, but also why was information handled the way that it has been handled?
Ever since 2015, looking at the emails that we had requested, you know, if you compare what was given by the governor's office to what was given by Adams County, it is evident that they're trying to hide something. Half of the 450 pages of emails, half of the information has been redacted. Now, if you look at the Adams County emails that were given to us, I mean, it's, you know, there's really no reason to redact the information. There wasn't any personal information or private information that, you know, that was regulated by HIPAA or anything like that. It's just a clear sign of, I think they realized, hey, they made a mistake, and now they're scrambling to fix it. And I think it's too late because, you know, not just one person, not just two people, not three people, but 13 people died. And it's just embarrassing. I mean, the Department of Public Health, you know, the director, he really should be ashamed of himself. And quite honestly, I don't know how he looks himself in the mirror, him and the governor.
Well, one of the things I know that's being talked about now in light of this latest report about the overhaul of the facility is the prospect of a capital bill. And
right.
It seems like there's all kinds of talk about a new public works bill and how desperate the state needs one. And the talk is fine until it gets to the point of, okay, how are you going to fund the thing?
Right. I think that, you know, tying this to a capital bill, this is the governor's way of doing politics. It's just a shame. I mean, he has the ability to move these people right now and pay for, you know, facility for these people to live in safely, and he's just not doing that. And we've been asking questions since 2015 from when the first Legionnaires outbreak took place. Hey, what's the status? We've asked him this in appropriations meetings, and we've been reassured every time that everything is fine. And then all of a sudden, you know, it's not. And it's just a shame, Rick. And some of these people, they really need to either correct it or need to move on from their job.
Do you think it's possible maybe just to do a limited bill only to help fund repairs in Quincy?
I do, but, you know, $265 million is the more cost-effective measure to build something new somewhere else or to repair the existing infrastructure. Like I said, it's 109 years old. You know, some of those pipes, they're old pipes. So, and when you start digging up some of the dirt around the facility, you may be, you know, kicking a hornet's nest. God knows what else is underneath there. And quite honestly, the weather is about to change down there as well. So when it gets hot out, you know, there's no telling, you know, what's going to get warmed up in those pipes. And I think it's, you know, maybe we should start looking at alternative options in a new facility or somewhere where it's safe.
We're speaking with Democratic State Senator Michael Hastings from Tinley Park. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in historic Tribune Tower and historic North Michigan Avenue. We're speaking with Democratic State Senator Michael Hastings from Tinley Park. Senator, I want to switch gears a little bit. I know you were very vocal in opposition to the state of Illinois' participation in the cross-check interstate voter registration system. And we learned later that the state of Illinois, State Board of Elections, did not get any kind of assurances about the security of voter information data that was being shared, and so was basically not going to take part in that program. Where do things stand with that as far as going forward? Do we need the legislation to take us out of it completely, or are you satisfied with what the State Board of Elections is doing?
Right now, the State Board of Elections, I think, took a very positive, they made a positive decision in delaying sending voter data to this multi-state system. Obviously, there were some concerns in terms of the information that we were sending. It was sensitive information. It was unsecured in the way we were sending it. And for whatever reason, the cross-check system wasn't able to provide those assurances. So until we get assurances that we're sending information safely across the internet, they decided not to do it. Now, in the event that they don't provide a secure method for sending sensitive voter information, then we'll go ahead and proceed with some more legislation. I know that Senator Raul, who's the Democratic nominee for Attorney General, him and I are working very closely on this, and we're just watching it, and we're going to see how this goes.
I know, too, there had been concerns about even our own kind of election security, the fact that apparently Russian agents were able to get into the State Board of Elections system. They did not change any data or anything, but perhaps had the ability to see some of the data. And now that there's There seems to be some movement of federal funds to the state. I know there was an Associated Press report saying that Illinois expects to receive about $13 million in federal funds to help update aging voting machines across the state. But yet, in the same case, you've got people in various local elections officials saying that federal money that was used a decade ago to buy machinery, those machines are breaking down, and that $13 million doesn't go very far when it comes to upgrading voting systems. You know, here again, we state that, you know, has a backlog of bills, has a backlog of problems, and it seems like now, where kind of scrutiny is on election security more than ever, we don't have the money to be able to help local election officials to be able to have secure voting machines.
Well, first, I think that the State Board of Elections addressed the Russian issue in 2016. I think they did the staff there really did a magnificent job. I know that sometimes there's bipartisanship in the board of the State Board of Elections, but the staff is dedicated to providing safe and secure elections. Now, when they realized what happened, they had really taken some extraordinary measures of shutting down the system and going ahead and evaluating what really happened. Luckily enough, we operate on two separate systems, and they found where Russia was able to come in and infiltrate our system, and they ended up closing that out. It was a very simplistic measure to do, but you know, there's so many things going on. Sometimes some people miss things, but I just want to say thanks to our awesome people. They did a great job. Now, the federal government, times are tough financially, but they're actually proposing a $386 million package to help with an advisory panel and guidelines so that we do have safe and secure elections. I know we'll see maybe not a lot of that, but this is a good start to show that people are serious about fixing this problem.
But it seems like more money is going to be needed. I mean, you're looking at
definitely,
you know, Macon County, in which is Decatur, basically saying they spent nearly $500,000 themselves to upgrade before the 2016 election.
Right.
And you know, even some of the smaller counties say Shelby County, they're trying to find $300,000 to replace machines, but the county itself has a budget deficit.
Yeah, there's this great old-fashioned thing called paper, Rick, and it doesn't require money for an upgrade, and it's pretty secure, especially with all the checks and balances. So there's a couple different options. You know, obviously, until they find the money to upgrade their security and their voting machines, they can always revert back to paper, although some people don't like doing that, especially with the ease of use of electronics. But, you know, especially in Illinois, times are tight, and we have our own budget constraints, and but I know this just from leading the investigation as the chairman of the subcommittee on cybersecurity, and bringing awareness to this has made people extra vigilant, and they're taking extraordinary measures to protect this system, and it's such a democracy is such a great thing, and I think people understand it, and they're more cognizant of it now. And honestly, I think people are more aware now than ever. And I think that's the first step, is making sure people understand this could happen and do everything we can to protect it.
I'm also on a technology-related issue. I know like over a year ago you had filed a Senate resolution urging the continuation of net neutrality and open Internet access. And now I understand there's legislation that states around the country are moving to try to ensure that on their own, and basically to overcome the actions, the federal actions.
You know, this it's going to come down to, obviously, the Attorney General's lawsuits to see what the decision is going to be. We're dealing with interstate commerce. Are we going to treat the Internet as a public utility, or are we going to treat this as an information service? I think these lawsuits are going to determine who has the authority to say whether there's throttling, whether there's prioritization in the Internet. And I think, you know, the courts will decide this one regardless of what the states do legislatively. So it's going to be interesting. You know, as a new chairman of the Energy Committee, Rick, I can tell you this. You know, in public utilities, you focus on it more. Is the Internet a public utility or is it an information service? And after touring the state and seeing all of our public utility facilities, you know, the Internet, the way it grows, the way it transforms, I'm not so sure we should treat it as a public utility. you know, I think it should be treated as something where people should be able to invest in and modernize, especially with the demand.
Well, you mentioned now about being the new Senate Energy Chairman. And, I mean, is there also a tie-in here with cybersecurity, since it seems like, you know, some of our power grid, our power systems, a great deal of concern about those being hacked?
Well, let me tell you, Rick, I went to Braidwood, our nuclear facility. I went to Kincaid, which is a coal-fired plant, visited ComEd's command center. We've been around the entire state. The number one question is how are you protecting the system? And some of the safeguards we have are unbelievable. You know, from a lowly intern at the National Security Agency when I was there, I had a chance to see some awesome things. But looking at what we have in Illinois is great. Now, are all the protections that we have going to prevent anyone from hacking our system? No. Everyone's going to be vulnerable. Everyone's going to have there's always that possibility of some sort of a breach. But the steps and the seriousness that our staff at those power plants and our power generating companies have, they are so serious. And the last thing they want is to see our lights go out. And that's one thing I'm concerned about. Is I want to make sure that we do have a safe and secure system, and we'll do everything we can to provide that to the residents of Illinois.
So you're satisfied with the steps that have been taken so far from what you've seen?
From what I've seen, Rick, I tell you what, it would take a sophisticated actor to really penetrate our system. And I can just tell you the protocols and what they do on a day-to-day basis to prevent breaches in the internet or in their computing systems. I mean, there's some pretty sophisticated protocols that they have. And not to mention, the leadership is so cognizant of this. You know, when I went to Braidwood, you know, not only did I have armed guards, you know, because of what's there at Braidwood, you know, their cybersecurity is just first class. But again, nothing's ever perfect. There's always susceptibility, and there's always an opportunity for someone to intrude. But I think we have some good checks and balances that'll prevent that.
Democratic State Senator Michael Hastings from Tinley Park, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Rick, you're the best. You guys have a great weekend. Great to talk to you.
Have a good weekend. We'll be back with more right after this.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. President Trump's new national economic advisor is on the job. Larry Kudlow admitted he's not a fan of tariffs, but he's accomplished, I guess, maybe one of his main tasks for the Trump administration, which is being able to go on TV. He's trying to explain Trump's actions against China and also urging some patience.
This is part of the process. And I'm not a fan of tariffs. I'm a free trader by and large. But I think the president is completely right to take these actions. Now, China is going to have its own tariff process. Bear in mind, Stu, these are just the first proposals, okay? In the United States, at least, we're putting it out for comment. It's going to take a couple months. I doubt if there'll be any concrete actions for several months. We'll see how that plays out. Nothing concrete has actually happened. These are proposals. But the message is clear. China has got to stop these unfair and illegal trading violations. They must. They've done it for years. They're operating outside the WTO. You know, part of the process here is the United States is going to the World Trade Organization. And I also I'd be very surprised if we didn't have huge backing. I call it a trade coalition of the willing. I think other nations around the world are going to join the USA, not only in tariff complaints, but also in WTO complaints.
That's Larry Kudlow on Fox News. Joining me now here in the Allstate Showcase studio is my good friend Amanda Vinicky, a political correspondent for WTTW Channel 11.
Good Welcome. Morning.
Good morning. Trade is a big issue for Illinois, particularly with China, and haven't really heard too much from the Rauner administration about these
Fancy
issues.
Fancy that. Well, anybody surprised?
It's good that they should be talking might be the usual response here.
Exactly. That is the typical Rauner response to anything when asked about President Donald Trump or, frankly, anything controversial generally.
Of national import that affects Illinois.
Sure. Or even, I mean, gun control, I guess that is a national import, but certainly of state import as well, with plenty of legislation before the General Assembly. And more often than not, I'm trying to think of an exception to this rule. The governor will say that I believe in talks, I believe in discussions, and won't say that he has any sort of opinion as to what route those talks should take, what conclusion they should reach.
Focus, Amanda.
Yes, that's his response.
His famed response to you on questions of that kind of
nature. Exactly. Well, asking is a pretty simple one. Did you vote for President Donald Trump was the question there. Certainly, this is an indication of the very difficult path that lies ahead of him. He is going to have to somehow get back on board the conservative Republicans who not only went for State Representative Jeanne Ives instead of him in the primary, but really disliked him. I mean, there's literally a book that was published by his primary opponent from his own party that of opposition research and why he is terrible. And now he has to try and win them over, as well as moderate Democrats who may, if you look at any polls, of course, President Trump not all that popular in many a pocket in Illinois where Rauner needs to do well. And then he's beloved, the president is, in certain areas, particularly downstate, where Rauner also needs support. Will that change? Because to get back to your point in terms of trade, these corn farmers, soy farmers, who
pork producers.
Are pork producers, yes, who are very much dependent on trade with China. And should the threats of trade war become a true war, they will really be hurting. And so we'll see if that affects Trump's popularity here and if that becomes any easier at all for Governor Bruce Rauner to walk that line. But,
well, when you look at the rural economy in Illinois, is the only thing that's really propping it up is the ability of those farmers to and the economic impact that they have on many of those communities. And when you start throwing tariffs in and counter tariffs from China coming into play, that ripples into an economy that's already very fragile.
Certainly, it can be very heartbreaking to visit certain downstate towns that are, you can see the hurt, you can see the pain, that ripple effect. You look at it still in Illinois' higher education community, which is struggling still from the budget impasse. I'll actually be going down to Southern Illinois University Carbondale later this coming week, and that is a place that was once thriving and still is seeing declines of enrollment in its flagship university down there at SIU. And that means that when you aren't having the students, you aren't having them spending money, of course, throughout the town. They didn't receive any money during this long budget impasse, which I think we'd need to continue to revisit. Yes, Illinois may now have a budget, but it's not as if there was an immediate recovery. And you have a lot of professors who were laid off. Who's going to buy a home that somebody's still paying a mortgage, trying to, when they're not getting a paycheck? Nobody else is either. You're not sure where things are going to go. There's certainly a ripple effect. And as you noted, I mean, Illinois, this ag economy is huge.
Well, you know, speaking of Carbondale, and I went there and then switched over to SIU Edwardsville, and I thought it was very interesting. There was a story in the news the other day about the fact
Edwardsville growing.
Because Edwardsville has become a true suburban community of St. Louis, and that looking at a gradual shift of resources from Carbondale to Edwardsville to deal with the increasing enrollment in Edwardsville, declining enrollment in Carbondale. And it's just mind-boggling to me that that is taking place, because SIU has always been Carbondale. And mm-hmm. that's why I'd always make sure I'd say it was SIU Edwardsville was where, right. where I went. But that says a lot, too, about that economy and Carbondale and the uncertainties that exist there. And it magnifies, I think, this whole issue of, yeah, we've got a budget, but nobody's really certain about anything.
They're less than certain. You know, just this week, there was another report from a credit ratings agency that noted that Illinois has been in a persistent crisis-like budget mode. And the only word that I wanted to dispute from that was crisis-like. Like, you take off the like. It has been in crisis mode, period. And it may be entering there again. Again, of course, Governor Bruce Rauner up for re-election, and we'll get there in just a moment.
Just
all right,
a break on time. You're getting ahead.
All right,
you're getting ahead of me here.
Stick with the crisis.
We're speaking with Amanda Vinicky, political correspondent for WTTW Channel 11 here in Chicago. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, joined here in the Allstate Showcase studio by Amanda Vinicky, political correspondent with WTTW Channel 11. Before the break, as you were leading the conversation here, I know we're exactly what we're headed to is the issue of, okay, we have a budget now, but it's an election year, a big election year. Mm-hmm. Will there be a budget for a full year when lawmakers return?
And that is the central question that will dominate.
You can't call it the $64 million question. It's more like a $64 billion question.
Exactly. Let's be clear, that has ramifications, not just for this year, but for down the road, I think. What's at play is, of course, that it would perhaps behoove Democrats politically to make Governor Bruce Rauner look as incompetent as possible, and doing that by once again failing to reach a budget agreement with the governor and with legislative Republicans, because then they can campaign and say, this is why we need Democrat J.B. Pritzker in the governor's mansion instead of Bruce Rauner. And that will once again put Illinois in this, quote, persistent crisis-like budget mode, which has ramifications for all of the entities, the social service groups, the higher education universities, what have you, that depend on the state for cash. So there may be an agreement, but also if you're Democrats who do have control of the General Assembly, you have a much easier time holding your breath, waiting for a Democrat to come in and take over.
Or do you do a six-month budget, right? Limited until we get past the election, we'll know who is governor, and then you
But then what are you dropping in the lap of the Democrat if it were to be a member of the, again, the General Assembly's controlling party, if a member of their own, now obviously J.B. Pritzker, were to come over? What do you put in his lap at that point in time? Certainly anything budget is much easier than it has been the past several years because of the income tax increase, which you're going to be hearing a ton about in these coming months. The governor talking about, Governor Rauner saying that he wants to roll it back and Pritzker wants to raise your taxes. The truth of that is that we don't know what Pritzker's plan is because he won't say.
Well,
he is giving zero specifics
beyond.
But isn't
that part of the problem?
And
it's a problem of his own making.
Yes.
And even to the point of saying, which we all know, although Democrats wanted a graduated income tax to replace the current flat tax. But he goes on to say, well, until that could happen, and it's questionable if it could, actually, mm-hmm. because of passing a constitutional amendment, that kind of thing. But in the meantime, raise the current 4.95% personal income tax rate to an undetermined amount, but there'll be exemption increases that'll be provided for. Okay, so what's that rate going to be? He won't say. But he wants to provide property tax relief and provide even additional funding to schools above and beyond the $350 million right. that's mandated under the new school aid formula. So what rate should that be? Well, I have to talk with legislators about
Throw my hands up. It's pretty, I mean, let's be clear, on both sides, both with Rauner and Pritzker are not being perhaps fair or too
transparent.
It's beyond transparent. I mean, it's worse than that, because I think there is arguably a damaging effect on democracy and trust in politicians and in people and what they believe can be done. It's as if you listen to the candidates for governor, it's going to magically be all better and you aren't going to have to pay any more. Yay! More money for everything, except for you're not going to have to pay for it. The governor is saying that he's going to roll back that income tax increase. He has like a tiny little marginal baby rollback plan,
which is conditional on shifting pension costs to local school districts,
which isn't going to happen. So done right there, but he's still going to campaign on it.
Right.
And Pritzker, on the other hand, making promises everywhere at every turn without giving any sort of detail. And again, it makes everybody, I think, either if you are tuned in, it makes you distrustful. Perhaps it makes you distrustful of politicians. And if you're not tuned in, you could look at it and say, well, hey, wait, I see them on TV making these promises. Why isn't that happening? And it's not happening.
But couldn't you argue that Bruce Rauner got elected without making any definitive proposals? And so if you're J.B. Pritzker, okay.
Oh, it's a winning playbook.
You want to try something new.
And you better believe that, again, that both of these individuals would turn on the other the very second that either would utter something
that was specific.
Was specific and would actually contain pain for people. They are walking very fragile, they're walking on thin ice here, and they're doing all they can to not crack it, because that crack would crack their chances of becoming the next governor of Illinois. And frankly, it's because we've all, put them out there. And I think the media, by and large, has done a very good job of telling it like it is. There's going to be some sort of pain, be it cuts, be it higher taxes, whatever the ramifications of either of those, both of which will have effects down the line. But it's pretty pathetic, truth be told.
But we can only do so much in the absence of specifics from the candidate.
Pointing out that there aren't any specifics,
right,
and the realities of the situation is what we try to do.
Let's go back to where we started very briefly here. Mm-hmm. This kind of narrow threading that Bruce Rauner has to do to move forward with his campaign. I mean, Jeanne Ives is still, okay, I vote for him, but I'm not endorsing him. I'm not part of any kind of unity divide here.
Last I checked, and granted, I haven't spoken with her, but I mean, she wouldn't even talk to him. It was, what's the point?
Right. And so not only does he have to try to heal a base, but grow it. And independents, potential Democrats, but he's got to try. It's a growth business for a general election. And I guess I have a hard time seeing where does that growth come from? Because first you got to heal the base.
Mm-hmm.
And this looks pretty split.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
I mean, 48% went to Ives. I mean,
it's that, and it was motivated, I think, 48%. Further, part of this is personality. The governor is not one. When asked about, would he have done anything differently? Did anything go wrong? He can't offer anything. He is not one for saying, I messed up, I'm sorry, what can I do to make things better? That is not the guy that we are dealing with. That's what I think a lot of people elected him for. They liked that about him. They wanted him to be the tough guy. But that makes the job even more difficult. This split, this schism over abortion is how it truly began. But there had been some festering, simmering Republican Party divides for quite some time. And then there was the abortion bill that eventually stoked Ives's candidacy really made that split come out into the air for everybody to notice and see. And yet, again, there's so much more than that. And guess what makes it a whole lot more difficult? After a primary where people's egos are wounded, where those who sided with Ives are very upset because they feel like the governor lied about her, it's going to be rough. I had said things aren't getting real. It got real a long time ago.
A long time ago. That's Amanda Vinicky, political correspondent for WTTW Channel 11 here in Chicago. Thank you so much for joining me this
morning. It was my pleasure. Have a great week, everyone.
We'll be back with more right after this.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase studio. And joining me here in the studio is Illinois House Republican Leader Jim Durkin of Western Springs. Leader Durkin, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Good morning, Rick. Glad to be here. Particularly in studio.
In studio, I'm very impressed, too, because I think the last time you were coming here was marathon time or something, and you ended up having to pull off the side of the road to do it by phone.
And I did it by phone, but the fact is we got the job done. That's the most important thing, right?
That is always the most important thing.
Kept up my commitment.
Thank you so much. Before we begin, I want to play a cut of State Representative Jeannie Ives, the Republican from Wheaton, who narrowly lost to Bruce Rauner in the Republican primary for governor. And she appeared on Eternal World Catholic Television Network, where she talked about her continued dissatisfaction with Governor Rauner. But she also talked about her caucus. I'll let you listen.
Okay.
Bruce Rauner lied about it. He told us that he was going to veto that bill, and then he signed it anyway. So he had to be challenged. And I'm glad that we stood up and challenged that governor. We came very close, closer than anybody expected. I always thought we could win, though. And I think the pro-life community needs a wake-up call. You need to watch your politicians carefully, and you need to hold them accountable for your votes. So challenging Bruce Rauner was about holding him accountable. And we will continue to hold him accountable as he plays out the rest of his term. And we will actually, we're a stronger caucus now, having been through that whole process. And we will hold politicians accountable in the future in the state of Illinois for their missed votes on this life issue.
And that's State Representative Jeannie Ives. How is the caucus?
Caucus is doing fine. We just went through a challenging primary cycle. I talk to my caucus on a regular basis, and a great deal of us. We lost one member through the primary, but the rest of us came through, and we're ready to go back to work next week. So we're going to continue with the same message and the same attitude we've had for the past 2 years, is that we will work with the Democrats on any issue as long as they respect the priorities of the Republicans. So our caucus is in a good position. Now, I think there was a lot of questions about where the caucus would be after the governor signed HB 40.
Which was the bill she was referring to. That's the bill that expanded taxpayer subsidies for abortions.
Here's what our caucus did. Shortly after that, we negotiated and we put significant amount of votes on a education reform bill, which was an incredible feat and an incredible lift in the legislature, something that's been around for 30 years. We did that on a bipartisan basis with Republicans and Democrats working together. I was very involved in that. The House Republicans, shortly after that, killed a very emotional but a very toxic bill that the operating engineers were pushing, which was a ban on local right to work, in which they expected to defeat the governor at an override. The House Republicans held together, and we defeated that bill. So our caucus is in a good place. You know, we have moments like everyone else, like every other family does throughout this country, where we have little spats, but at the end of the day, we come together, and we will continue to be a unified team as we go back into Springfield.
But is the caucus affected by this kind of division that we saw in the governor's race?
No. You know, nobody likes to lose, and you know what? There's winners and losers in the election cycle. Our caucus can see through that because we know that at the end of the day, our members are, and I would say that Representative Ives as well, And we agree with the governor on pension reform. We believe in balanced budgets. We believe in creating a better economic and a better job climate in Illinois. There is a difference of opinion with HB 40, but think of all the things that we agree on with the governor. And we're going to have to get past it. So we have an election coming up next November, and Republicans throughout the state have to make a decision, and I think they will, that they are, we are going to hold together. There's too much at stake. A Pritzker governorship for the state of Illinois is not an alternative, and we cannot go back. So, you know, I know there's some old wounds that have to be healed, but we'll be fine. We'll get together. We'll get back together.
Well, one of the basis of her candidacy was that basically that HB 40 bill and the governor's signature on it, and it seems interesting about how abortion still continues to be such a divisive issue within the Republican Party.
It always has been, and it to a certain extent with the Democrats. We have different groups that feel very strong about social issues on both sides. But
I guess I wonder about single issue voters.
Single issue voters are, are they going to next November, Republicans who did not support the governor in the primary, are they going to stay home? I doubt it, because J.B. Pritzker, I believe, is going to do everything he can to show that he is more abortion rights than Governor Rauner. And that, to me, is not mainstream Illinois. And the governor has been very clear about his position. This is not a priority for the governor on these social issues. The governor's priorities are fixing Illinois' economy. The governor was forced to take an issue on HB 40, a bill that has been sitting around in the legislature for over 8 years, and they conveniently found a time to call it to make sure that they can create some havoc within the Republican Party. But I don't believe that when people understand who J.B. Pritzker is and what he stands for on social issues, that they will not stay home, and then they will support our nominee, the governor.
So you believe that that's an energizing issue? Because, I mean, there's been concern about what is there an enthusiasm deficit that is going to carry out in the fall regarding Republican turnout versus the talked about Democratic wave.
You know what? I've been around this for a while, and people's attitudes can change very quickly, nationally and also locally. I think we're going to be driven a lot. What's going to drive a lot of the vote next November is going to be what's happening on the national level, but also how people think the state of Illinois is, and do they think that a Democrat-controlled legislature, I hope that the House, that we were able to pick up more seats and actually maybe take the majority, but if that's not the case, having a Democrat at the top of the ticket who is already right out of the gate talking about a progressive tax, talking about all sorts of things that it just really don't fly with mainstream Illinois. There's more at stake in next November's state elections than there is anywhere nationally. And I've said this time and time again that the legislature has a greater impact on the day-to-day lives of Illinoisans than whatever Washington does. So it's our job. Governor is the leader of the party. He's up for re-election. It's his job, it's our job, it's my job to be able to communicate to Illinoisans that there is still an opportunity for us to fix the state of Illinois without having to continue down the status quo, which is what the Democrats have been expecting and what they've demanded over the past many years.
We're speaking with the Illinois House Republican leader, Jim Durkin from Western Springs. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, joined here in the Allstate Showcase studio by Illinois House Republican Leader Jim Durkin. Leader Durkin, we have a call from Ron. Ron, as always, welcome to the show.
Yes, Representative Durkin, quick question. What's the strategy? You mentioned the priorities of the party. Going into the general, do you try to reach out there to the conservative base to challenge the governor, or do you look at maybe expanding, reaching out to the Democrat Party? Lastly, this is the first time in a long time that I think this state will possibly come in a blue state and the Republican Party becoming irrelevant. It's a crucial election coming up, so let me know, what is the party strategy? Thank you.
Thank you, Ron.
Look, the party strategy for this between now and November is not just going to shore up and try to bring back the conservative bases, but it's also to go to the moderate and the independent voters and also Democrats who I live in the West Suburbs, and it's a interesting area. A lot of South Side Chicago is a lot of young Democrat families have moved out to the Western Suburbs, and they voted Democrat their whole life. They are not voting Democrat again the rest of their life now that they're out here. They are dissatisfied with the leadership at the top of the ticket from Speaker Madigan all the way down to the top. These are young families who've strived to, do better for themselves, who are looking at a J.P. Pritzker who's automatically saying that I'm going to raise your taxes after I get elected. Don't do too well. Don't work too hard because you're just going to pay more. That's the message you get from J.B. Pritzker. So be average, and then you'll be able to succeed. But having a some type of balance of power where you do have checks and balances is the best way of operating in Illinois. Having a Pritzker, Madigan, Cullerton, Illinois, I think that portrait is something that will be rejected in time over the next many months. But if Illinoisans want that, I think they need to understand that, their taxes are going to continue to go up. There will be a union-driven state. The job creation and the exodus of Illinois is going to be even worse. But it's going to have to be a lot of work on behalf of the governor and also many of us to be able to say to our conservative friends that we agree on everything other than one issue. I didn't support the governor on HB 40, but I also believe that we have monumental deficits, structural deficits in the state of Illinois that need to be fixed with pension reform, balanced budgets, tax reform. These are things that we agree on. And at the end of the day, that is what hits people the most. Social issues are put there, and this was placed as a very strategic move by the Democrats to place the Republican governor into a trick bag, but they should see through it. But we're going to appeal back to the independents and also the dissatisfied Democrats who are right now questioning the leadership of their party, and we see that every cycle. We've had success in the House of Representatives over the last cycle. In the last two elections against the Speaker's had a net gain of zero, and we've picked up four seats. We've taken him out of the supermajority, and we've stopped him over 130 times in the House of Representatives on passing bills, many of them significant bills, which have had a dramatic effect. A traumatic effect upon Illinois' economy.
Let's talk about returning to Springfield now after the long break. And Amanda Vinick and I discussed this a little bit earlier about prospects for a budget and whether you have any expectations that there will be a full year budget coming from Democrats, because obviously everything is going to be hyper partisan, hyper political when it comes to the General Assembly.
Well, my communication to the Speaker 2 months ago was to work on a full-year budget, one that's fair, it's balanced, it's realistic, one where revenues match up with our expenditures, which were required under the Constitution, and I'm going to reaffirm that very soon with him. What the Speaker needs to realize, and also all of the members of his caucus need to know, is that the battle lines have been drawn. We know what the issues that are at stake in November. The Speaker does not have to go down and spend a month of gotcha votes. He's got an arsenal of those ahead of him. So my plea to him, or request to him, is that let's spend the next 6-7 weeks on putting together a full year budget, one which is balanced, one which we actually, how about this? Do something that's required by statute, and that is to recognize and to acknowledge a revenue estimate from our agencies to determine how much money we will have for this upcoming fiscal year, and then we can work our budget that way. So that's my request to him. Now, if he chooses not to do that and have a six-month budget, what he's going to do is that he's going to put social service agencies, universities, K through 12, and everybody else who relies upon state government back into peril And I would suggest that is a very dangerous, dangerous attitude to take, is that, well, we feel confident that maybe we'll win the next November's governor's election and then we'll start all over again and we'll have a Democrat budget which is going to be significantly more taxes upon Illinoisans, a bad economic environment, there'll be no business reforms, and it'll continue the exodus of Illinoisans and businesses out of the state of Illinois if it's going to be a six-month budget. So my plea to him is, let's do something that we should have done many years ago, and that's to actually work, negotiate in a bipartisan manner on a balanced budget.
I talked to State Senator Michael Hastings earlier in the show about the issue of Quincy Veterans Home and how there's that study that's been out about $278 million needed to basically redo the Quincy Veterans Home, and how there seems to be, that seems to be coupled with some renewed talk of the potential of a new capital bill, a new public infrastructure bill. And there's been always talk about a capital bill. It's been so long, but it stops at talk because no one wants to pay for it. And so I'm not sure that I see any capital bill on the horizon, certainly not in an election year.
Well, I think it's, you know, as we all kind of understand, Springfield, does the Speaker and the Democrat power structure want to give the governor the ability to go around the state of Illinois and say that we've delivered on a number of projects that have been long overdue, the ribbon-cutting ceremonies and whatnot? I don't think the Democrats want to give the governor that luxury. But with respect to Quincy, it's a very challenging situation, which is every day that there's new challenges. I'm happy that we have a very decorated veteran who's ran the Central Management Services, Mike Hoffman, running the situation down there. There's no easy answer. And I hope that what we do is in the best interest of, we have to, it's going to be in the best interest of the residents and also the employees of that location. But remember, we have Legionnaires in the state capitol. These are old buildings. There's no quick solution to solving this problem. But we do know there's a problem that has to be addressed. We have to be sensitive, mindful of what we can do. But with all, so with respect to Quincy, these are very fragile individuals who are living there. And we have to be very careful and know exactly what is in the best interest of them. We need to know what their priorities are. But the administration is doing everything you can with what they have, to make the situation, to stabilize the situation as much as they can, but also coming forward with a plan and how we can make this a better situation. But again, old buildings bring old problems. And, you know, we just can't uproot the state capitol and say that we're going to displace everyone, because we do have Legionella in our water systems, in our, you know, in the chambers.
It's an old building.
It is.
And there's been a lot of old people around that building, too.
That's what I hear.
That's what you hear. That's Illinois House Republican Leader Jim Durkin of Western Springs. Thank you so much for joining me here in studio this
morning.
Thank
you, Rick. Glad to be here.
We'll be back with more right after this. Well, that's all we have time for on this week's edition of the Sunday Spin. I want to thank my guest, State Senator Mike Hastings from Tinley Park, Amanda Vinicky from WTTW Channel 11, and Illinois House Republican Leader Jim Durkin of Western Springs. Most of all, I want to thank all of you for listening on this sunny Sunday morning.